Chapter 3. One step back, two steps forward. The cats of Egypt 2,000 years ago probably differed little in their behavior from modern cats. These cats were not yet so varied in appearance and still consisted of a single, rather homogeneous population with no pedigrees or distinctive types. Few obstacles would then have been apparent to stand in the path of the cat's inexorable rise to universal companion animal. However, this was not to be achieved for another 2,000 years, partly because the cat had only a single practical role. The dog, the cat's primary rival for human affection and attention, has adapted to serve many more functions, guarding, hunting, herding, to name but three, than the less malleable cat. Two other major factors also delayed the cat's rise to prominence, especially in Europe. First, the cat derived from a specialist carnivore, leaving it ill-suited to scavenge for a living when prey was scarce. Second, the cat continued a long association with Egyptian religion, at first a blessing, granting the cat time to evolve into a domestic animal, but later a curse. Surprisingly, Europeans' view of cats continued to be heavily influenced by Egyptian cat worship until as recently as about 400 years ago. Worship of Bastet, Bubastis, and other pagan deities associated with cats, such as Diana and Isis, was popular in southern Europe, especially from the 2nd to the 6th centuries CE. In some places, this worship lasted much longer. For example, Ypres, a Belgian city that celebrates its connections with cats to this day, outlawed cat worship only in 962 CE, while a cult based around the goddess Diana lingered in parts of Italy until the 16th century. Women managed most of these cults, focusing on motherhood, the family, and marriage. When Christianity began to establish itself as the preeminent religion of Europe, cats began to suffer from their affiliation with pagan practices. The spread of cats from the eastern Mediterranean into Western Europe and into all strata of society was hastened by the custom of keeping cats on ships of all sizes. This habit likely arose for the practical purpose of keeping mice away from cargo and soon became superstition, with many sailors refusing to sail in ships that had lost their cats. Ships often displayed carved images of cats on the prow to bring good luck. Their obvious utility aside, cats must have continued to benefit from increasingly warm relationships with their human owners. In many ways, the vicissitudes of the cat's popularity over the past two millennia can be attributed to changes in the balance between two key influences, superstition and affection. The Romans are often credited with introducing the domestic cat to Britain, but some evidence suggests that they had already arrived several centuries earlier. Cat and house mouse bones were found at two Iron Age hill forts dating to 2,300 years ago, a few dozen miles apart in southern England. The cats were mostly young animals, with the youngest five newborn kittens. These hill forts, inhabited by as many as 300 people, led by a local chieftain, were the focal point for several surrounding farmsteads, each of which supplied grain to large stores kept in the fort, perhaps holding 20 times as much as each individual farm. These stores inevitably became infested with mice, so cats would have been a useful addition to the domestic fauna. These cats must have been brought from the Mediterranean, since it is highly unlikely that the local wild cats, though of the same species, Felix sylvestris sylvestris, could have been tamed or even tolerated being in close proximity to people for long enough to produce kittens. Wildcats of European origin are notoriously wary of humans nowadays, and have probably always been so, judging from early Greek accounts of attempts to tame them. The most likely way domestic cats would have reached Britain is on Phoenician ships. The Phoenicians did not colonize Britain, but they did visit, chiefly to buy tin for the manufacture of bronze. And, since they often carried cats on their vessels, the presence of domestic cats near the south coast of Britain is unsurprising. Indeed, the grain the Phoenicians brought to Britain on earlier voyages had quite possibly brought the house mice that the cats were called on to eliminate. Indeed, the Phoenicians may subsequently also have supplied the cats as a way of clearing up the problem they had themselves created. Cats likely became widespread in Britain during the Roman occupation. Archaeologists at the Roman town of Silchester, in what is now Hampshire, found a clay floor tile dating from the 1st century AD bearing the impression of a cat's foot. Presumably, the cat strayed into the drying yard before the tile had set. Other tiles unearthed at the same site bore the footmarks of a dog, a deer, a calf, a lamb, an infant, and a man with a hobnailed sandal, indicating that the Romans' reputation for quality control was not infallible. The wane of Roman influence in northern Europe seems to have had little effect on the popularity of the cat. For the 500 years of the European Dark Ages, cats were highly valued for their rat and mouse-catching skills. Footnote. Perhaps fortunately for the domestic cat's popularity, the brown rat, Rattus norvegicus, much larger and formidable than the black rat, did not spread across Europe until the late Middle Ages. As it advanced, it gradually displaced the plague-carrying black rat from the towns and cities. Now black rats are generally found only in warmer places. Most cats are not powerful or skillful enough to take on a full-grown brown rat, although they can be an effective deterrent to brown rat colonization or recolonization. End of note. Several statutes mention cats specifically, showing just how valuable they were. One such statute from Wales in the 10th century stated, "The price of a cat is fourpence. Her qualities are to see, to hear, to kill mice, to have her claws whole, and to nurse and not devour her kittens. If she be deficient in any one of these qualities, one-third of her price must be returned." Note that this refers specifically to a female cat. Toms were perhaps not regarded as equally precious. Fourpence was also the value of a full-grown sheep, goat, or untrained house dog. A newborn kitten was valued at 1 penny, the same as a piglet or a lamb, and a young cat at 2. In a divorce, the husband had the right to take 1 cat from the household, but all the rest belonged to the wife. In Saxony, Germany, the penalty for killing a cat at this time was 60 bushels of grain, almost 500 gallons, or more than 1,500 kilograms, emphasizing the cat's value at keeping granaries free of mice. Cats must also have helped to slow the spread of the rat-borne bubonic plague that swept through Europe in the 6th century following the wanton destruction of the drinking water and sewage systems built by the Romans. Cats are themselves susceptible to bubonic plague, so they must also have died in large numbers, but evidently many survived. Despite their self-evident usefulness and the considerable monetary value placed upon them, cats' welfare was not given the same respect it is today. In Greece, sacrifice and mummification of cats continued much as it had in Egypt, except that drowning rather than strangulation seems to have become the preferred method of killing. An ancient Celtic tradition of burying or killing cats to bring good luck spread across Europe, and, given the value evidently placed on female cats, the usual victims were likely males. A cat would be killed and buried in a newly sown field to ensure the growth of the crop. A new house could be protected from mice and rats by putting a cat, whether dead or alive at the time of interment is unclear, and a rat into a specially constructed hole in an outside wall, or by placing them together under new floorboards. Footnote. Researchers have found numerous examples of this in Britain, France, and Spain, so this superstition must have been in an organ pipe in Dublin's Christchurch Cathedral, Dublin, although the official story holds that they were trapped there by accident. End of note. Many European cities had a feast day custom of putting several cats in a basket together, which would have been stressful enough in itself, and then suspending it over a fire. The screams of the cats were supposed to ward off evil spirits. An alternative was to throw cats from the top of a tower, an event the citizens of Ypres still commemorate every May as the Kattenstoet, Festival of the Cats, using stuffed toys as substitutes for actual cats. Remarkably, some of these rituals persisted into modern times in their original form. In 1648, Louis XIV presided over one of the last cat burnings in Paris, lighting the bonfire himself and then dancing in front of it before leaving for a private banquet. The last time live cats were thrown from the bell tower in Ypres was as recently as 1817. However repugnant such rituals may seem today, they cannot have accounted for more than a tiny fraction of the cat population. Overall, cats probably thrived during the Dark Ages. Indeed, whenever mice were plentiful, cats would have bred prolifically, producing a surplus of kittens that would need to be culled, often by drowning, to prevent overpopulation. Cats in general were regarded as disposable, like any other farm animal. Cat skins were commonly used in clothing, and butchery marks on cat bones recovered from medieval sites show that many were killed specifically for their fur as soon as they were fully grown. Such practices would presumably have contributed to a prevailing notion that cats' lives were disposable, making their ritual sacrifice much less abhorrent then than it would be today. Initially benevolent, the attitude of the church towards cats gradually became more hostile as the Dark Ages gave way to the Middle Ages. The Roman Catholic Church first set itself on a road that ended in the wholesale persecution of cats when, in 391 CE, the Emperor Theodosius I banned all pagan and heretical Christian worship, including all the cults devoted to Bastet and Diana. Initially, the worshippers themselves, not their cats, were targeted. Indeed, cats seem to have been favored animals in the early Irish church. The Book of Kells, an 8th-century Irish illuminated book of the Gospels, features several illustrations of cats, some demonic and others depicted in domestic settings. Irish clerics may have encouraged an appreciation of cats as companions. The poem Pangurban by a 9th-century monk compared the writer's life to that of his cat. Myself and Pangur, cat and sage, go each about our business. I harass my beloved page, he his mouse, and his delight when his claws close on his prey equals mine when sudden clues light my way. In the Middle Ages, monasteries must have been particularly valuable to cats because of their fish ponds, used to raise the fish eaten during Lent, the liturgical season of the late winter and early spring when meat-eating was forbidden. Fish were plentiful and great sources of protein, and livestock were slaughtered months before because little fodder was available to feed them in the winter months. Cats, often pregnant during these months, would have been happy to turn from hunting mice to scavenging fish scraps, thereby gaining nutrition essential to the well-being of their unborn kittens, and an advantage over their heathen counterparts on nearby farms. The relationship between church and cat became seriously antagonistic from the 13th to 17th centuries, threatening the very survival of the domestic species in some parts of continental Europe. In 1233, the Catholic Church began a concerted attempt to exterminate cats from continental Europe. On June 13th of that year, Pope Gregory IX's notorious Vox in Rama was published. In this papal bull, cats, especially black cats, were identified specifically with Satan. Over the next 300 years, millions of cats were tortured and killed, along with hundreds of thousands of their mainly female owners who were suspected of witchcraft. Urban populations of cats were decimated. The justification for this barbarism was essentially the same as it had been in the 4th century. The extermination of cults that still included cats in their worship, and the demonization of rival religions such as Islam. But now it was the cats themselves that bore the brunt of the church's wrath. Outside Western Europe, cats were generally better tolerated at this time. The Eastern Greek Orthodox Church appears to have had little quarrel with cat-keeping. Islam has a tradition of kindness to cats, so cats continued to thrive in the Middle East. In Cairo, the Sultan Baybars, ruler of Egypt and Syria, founded what was probably the first sanctuary for homeless cats in 1280 CE. Even within the reach of the Church of Rome, cats were not universally reviled. In Britain, cats feature in 14th century poetry of the time, including Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. If the steward's tale is accurate, then cats were well tended, as well as appreciated for their mouse-catching skills. Let's take a cat and raise him well with milk and tender meat and make his couch of silk. Then let him see a mouse go by the wall. At once he'll leave the milk and meat and all, and every dainty that is in the house, such appetite he has to eat a mouse. Moreover, it appears that cats were secretly popular even in ecclesiastical circles. Carvings of cats adorn the choir stalls of medieval churches right across Europe, including Britain, France, Switzerland, Belgium, Germany, and Spain. These cats are depicted not as demons, but in natural or domestic situations, washing themselves, caring for kittens, and sitting by the fireside. It may be that such carvings were deliberately placed out of view of the general congregation, since presumably sermons sometimes referred to cats as demonic. Although cats and the women who doted on them were sporadically persecuted, cats were generally tolerated for their usefulness, not least in rural areas where the reach of the church was weakest and the services cats provided were most appreciated. Did this reversal in its fortunes have any lasting impact on the cat as a domesticated animal? No physical trace of the persecution of black cats in Western Europe remains. Today, the black mutation is as common in Germany and France as it is in Greece, Israel, or North Africa, all of which were outside the influence of the medieval Catholic Church. Sometime during the Middle Ages, cats, which were significantly larger and more wildcat-like up until Roman times, became smaller, in some locations even smaller than the average cat of today. Although persecution might have influenced this, it is difficult to pinpoint the time or place that the changes in size occurred. In part, this is because it is rare for sufficiently large numbers of cat bones to be found in one place to give an accurate picture of what the average cat might have looked like. For example, researchers would presume that the remains of a single large cat found anywhere in Europe are those of a wild cat and an extra small cat, the product of malnutrition. In Western Europe, the cat seems to have changed in size over the centuries, but not consistently. For example, in York, in the 10th and 11th centuries, domestic cats were the same size they are today, but at the same period in Lincoln, a scant 80 miles away, cats were mostly small by today's standards. However, by the 12th and 13th centuries, York cats had become smaller than their counterparts of 200 years earlier. In Hedeby, Germany, cats of the 9th through 11th centuries were roughly the same size as they are today, but in Schleswig, also in Germany, some of the cats recovered from 11th through 14th century remains were tiny. A staggering and unexplained 70% reduction in bone lengths seems to have occurred between the 11th and 14th centuries. Many of the cats found in Schleswig, which seem to have left no descendants, would look tiny compared to a typical 21st century cat. We might be tempted to ascribe this miniaturization to the persecution that began in the 14th century, but we have no direct evidence that this was the case. Indeed, the reduction in size in England predates the papal proclamation. As such, the cause of these shifts towards smaller cats remains a mystery, and we do not know when cats grew larger again. Likewise, we might be tempted to link the persecution of cats to the Black Death, a pandemic of rat-borne bubonic plague that swept from China to Britain from 1340 through 1350. More than a third of Europe's human population died, along with many of its cats. However, the plague was just as devastating in India, the Middle East, and North Africa, where cats remained unpersecuted, as it was in Western Europe. Evidently the bacillus was simply too virulent to be contained, and indeed plague continued to break out in Europe occasionally over the next 500 years. The last major epidemic in Britain was the Great Plague of London of 1665 to 66, and this time cats, not rats, were blamed. 200,000 cats were slaughtered on the Lord Mayor of London's orders. Footnote: at this time, cats were also considered generally detrimental to good health. The French physician Ambroise Paré described the cat as a venomous animal which infects through its hair, its breath, and its brains. And in 1607, the English cleric Edward Topsell wrote, "It is most certain that the breath and savour of cats destroy the lungs." End of note. 17th century Britain was not a good time and place to be a cat, nor were the new colonies in North America. As a result of their link to the remnants of paganism in rural communities, cats, again especially black cats, had become associated with witchcraft. We see remnants of this association today in horror films and Halloween decorations. When communities tried witches for their crimes, they often claimed that the witches could transform themselves into cats. They also mentioned other animals, including dogs, moles, and frogs, but cats were the most common. Thus, the Church of Rome gave its official sanction to cruelty toward cats. Anyone coming upon a cat after dark was justified in killing or maiming it on the grounds that it might be a witch in disguise. On the Scottish island of Mull, one black cat after another was roasted alive for 4 days and 4 nights in an exorcism referred to as the Tygam. Colonial leaders brought these same prejudices to Massachusetts, culminating in the Salem witch trials of 1692 to 93. The reputation of the cat began to improve in mid-18th century Europe. Louis XV, the great-grandson of the same Louis XIV who had lit a Paris bonfire under a basket of cats, was, at least, tolerant of them, allowing his wife Maria and her courtiers to indulge their pet cats every whim. It became fashionable for such pets to be incorporated into paintings of French ladies of title, and special tombs were built for favoured animals when they died. However, such attitudes were far from universal. Around the same time, the naturalist Georges Buffon wrote in his definitive 36-volume Histoire naturelle, générale et particulière, "The cat is an unfaithful domestic and kept only through necessity to oppose to another domestic which incommodes us still more and which we cannot drive away." Meanwhile, in England, cats were growing in popularity. 18th century poets Christopher Smart and Samuel Johnson not only valued the company of cats, but also wrote about them. Smart's poem, "For I Will Consider My Cat, Geoffrey," begins, "For I will consider my cat, Geoffrey, for he is the servant of the living God, duly and daily serving him. For at the first glance of the glory of God in the east, he worships in his way, for this is done by wreathing his body 7 times round with elegant quickness." Implying that Smart saw no link between cats and devil worship, indeed quite the opposite. Smart was also an acute observer of cat behaviour. The poem continues, "For first he looks upon his forepaws to see if they are clean. For secondly he kicks up behind to clear away there. For thirdly he works it upon stretch with the forepaws extended. For fourthly, he sharpens his paws by wood. For fifthly, he washes himself. For sixthly, he rolls upon wash. For seventhly, he flees himself, that he may not be interrupted upon the beat. For eighthly, he rubs himself against a post. For ninthly, he looks up for his instructions. For tenthly, he goes in quest of food." Likewise, Samuel Johnson adored his cats, Hodge and Lily. His biographer James Boswell wrote, "I never shall forget the indulgence with which he treated Hodge, his cat," possibly referring to Johnson's habit of feeding Hodge oysters, which, it must be said, were not the luxury food then that they are now. Toward the end of the 19th century, the cat completed its transformation to domestic status. In Britain, Queen Victoria kept a succession of pet cats. Her Angora white heather was one of the consolations of her old age, surviving her to become the pet of her son Edward VII. In the United States, Mark Twain was not only a cat enthusiast, but also, like Smart, an acute observer of their nature. By what right has the dog come to be regarded as a noble animal? The more brutal and cruel and unjust you are to him, the more your fawning and adoring slave he becomes. Whereas, if you shamefully misuse a cat once, she will always maintain a dignified reserve toward you afterward. You will never get her full confidence again. By the 19th century, cats became far more varied in appearance than their ancestors in Egypt. At different times, and in various places in Europe and the Middle East, new coat types appeared due to spontaneous genetic mutations. Sometimes these disappeared after a few generations, particularly if cat owners regarded the mutations as freakish. However, sometimes unusual-looking cats must have found sympathetic owners who treasured these unique differences. If this preference came to be shared by local owners and then spread to other places, the underlying mutation might gradually spread through the general population and thereby became part of the range of variation that we see in today's cats. Different colors, different patterns, both long and short hair. Remarkably, we can still trace the origins and spread of some of these changes even in today's multifarious cat populations. Geneticists credit the comparative homogeneity of household cats across Europe and the Middle East to the European habit of keeping cats on ships. For example, we can easily imagine a litter of kittens conceived in Lebanon being born 2 months later in Marseille after their mother had jumped ship. Seagoing Phoenicians, Greeks, and Romans spread cats around the Mediterranean, and the genetics of cats in France still shows traces of the trade route up the River Rhône from the Mediterranean and then down the Seine to the English Channel. The distribution of the orange tabby mutation in northern Europe still shows the effects of its popularity with Viking invaders almost 1,000 years ago. Footnote: hand-reared kittens often end up spending their entire lives with the person that hand-reared them. Whether this is because the kittens are difficult to home or whether their human foster parents cannot bear to give them away seems to be unknown. End of note. The first evidence for domestic cats that did not have striped coats comes not long after the beginning of the Christian era. The Greeks first described black cats and white cats in the 6th century CE, but the black mutation, which occurs quite regularly, may have been spreading through the domestic population for several centuries before. Many of the cats that carry this mutation are not actually black. The black color is caused by an inherited inability to produce the normal pale hair tips that give wildcats their brownish appearance, which is known technically as agouti. The hairs then revert to their basic color, black, but only if the cat carries two copies of this mutation, one inherited from its mother and one from its father. If it carries one normal copy and one mutant, then the normal copy is dominant and its coat will be the usual tabby. Thus, a male and female pair of such cats, outwardly tabby, could produce a black kitten alongside their other tabby kittens. The black mutation is widespread among today's cats, wherever in the world they are found, suggesting that it may have originated before the Phoenicians and Greeks began spreading domestic cats around Europe. Black cats and white cats are not only opposites in terms of color, they are also opposite in terms of their relationship with humankind. Cats can be all white, either because they are albino, in which case their eyes will be pink, or because they carry a mutation, dominant white. Both tend to be less healthy than normal cats. Not only are they prone to skin cancer, but blue-eyed, dominant white cats are often deaf. Perhaps more importantly, unlike their striped counterparts, all white cats stand out against almost any background, so are unlikely to find it easy to catch enough food to sustain themselves. Outside the pedigree population, in which dominant white coats have been deliberately bred into some breeds, all white cats are uncommon, rarely forming more than 3% of the free-ranging cat population. By contrast, the black mutation is so common and widespread that it must not bring any major biological disadvantage to the cats that carry it. In some places, more than 80% of cats carry this mutation. Not that all or even most of these cats will actually have black coats, since many will have only one copy of the mutation and are therefore striped. Today, black is commonest in Britain and Ireland, in Utrecht in the Netherlands, in the city of Chiang Mai in northern Thailand, in a few US cities such as Denton, Texas, holding the current record at almost 90% incorporation, in Vancouver, and also in Morocco. Since black has not always been everyone's favorite color for a cat, this ubiquity is difficult to fathom. Since cultural explanations appear not to fit, scientists have proposed a biological basis for the pervasiveness of the black mutation. That possession of this mutation, even one invisible copy, the heterozygote, somehow makes the cat more friendly to people and or other cats, thereby giving the cats that carry it an advantage in high-density living situations or in prolonged, unavoidable contact with people, such as on board a ship. This hypothesis runs counter to a recent study of cats in Latin America. Here, roughly 72% of cats carry the black mutation, similar to the proportion in Spain, from where most South American cats must have come. We can estimate the number of long journeys that cats must have taken between Spain and each of the various Hispanic colonies by tracing their paths along the trade routes. The ancestors of the cats of La Paz, 13,000 feet above sea level in the Andes, completed many such journeys, but black cats are no more common here than in Spain. Any cat that traveled this far must have been remarkably tolerant of people. Thus we cannot yet convincingly explain either the overall numbers of black cats or their local variations. The classic or blotched tabby pattern exhibits the most remarkable distribution, although the reasons for its prevalence in some areas and not in others are not entirely clear. The cat's wild ancestor had a striped or mackerel tabby coat, and all domestic cats probably carried the genes for this pattern until at least 2,000 years ago, and possibly even more recently. Footnote: even black cats carry the genes for one or other of the tabby patterns, but because the hairs that should be brown at the tips are black, the pattern doesn't show, or at least not until the cat gets old, when the hairs that would be brown if they weren't black fade to a dark, rusty color. A tabby pattern can also be just discernible in black kittens for a few weeks. Another variation of the tabby gene, Abyssinian, restricts the black stripes to the head, tail, and legs, while the body is covered in brown-tipped hairs. This is quite rare, except in the pedigree cats of the same name. End of note. The mutation for the blotched tabby pattern probably first took hold sometime in the late Middle Ages, and almost certainly in Britain, where it is the commonest pattern today. Like the black mutation, blotched tabby is recessive. For a cat to have a blotched tabby coat, it must have two copies of the blotched version of the gene, one inherited from its mother and one from its father. One striped, one blotched, and the cat will have a striped coat. Despite this apparent handicap, in Britain and in many parts of the United States, blotched tabbies outnumber striped tabbies about 2 to 1, meaning that more than 80% of cats carry the blotched version of the gene. In many parts of Asia, blotched tabbies are rare or even absent. The main exceptions are a few former British colonies such as Hong Kong, which were presumably simultaneously colonized by British cats, either ship's cats or the pets of the settlers. For a new version of a gene, especially a recessive gene, to spread through a population, it must provide some advantage. Since striped cats had been in Britain since Roman times and probably earlier, blotched tabbies must have been rare to begin with. They probably reached 10% of the population by about 1500 CE, and then increased year after year until they reached their current near ubiquity. In Britain, blotched tabby is sometimes referred to as classic tabby, as if the striped version were the mutation, not the other way around. The reason for the ascendancy of the blotched pattern is still unknown. British cat owners do not prefer the blotched to the striped coat, at least not to the extent that this could account for their proportions among British pets. In fact, when asked, they express a small preference for striped tabby, perhaps simply because it is, now, relatively unusual. Blotched tabby does not seem to provide any better or worse camouflage than striped, at least in the countryside. There has been a suggestion that the pollution caused by the Industrial Revolution, coating British cities in soot, favoured darker cats, both blotched tabby and black, because they were less conspicuous, but this has never been confirmed. Footnote: we measured the closeness of the relationship by asking the owners how likely they would be to turn to their cat for emotional support in each of 9 situations, for example, after a bad day at work or when they were feeling lonely. End of note. Still, we know that almost all genes have multiple effects, even though most are named for the most obvious change they bring about. Therefore, the blotched version of the gene possibly produces some other advantage, nothing to do with the coat, that somehow suited cats to life in Britain. We see the rise of the blotched tabby gene in Britain reflected in the proportion of blotched tabbies in former British colonies all around the world. In the northeastern United States, New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, settled by Europeans in the 1650s, only about 45% of cats carry the blotched tabby gene, but this is considerably more than in originally Spanish-settled areas, such as Texas, at around 30%, where cats look much like those in Spain today. The Atlantic provinces of Canada, settled some 100 years later, have more blotched tabbies. European colonies settled in the 19th century are more variable. Hong Kong in particular has fewer than it should, probably because there was already a striped tabby population of Chinese origin there, thus diluting the effect of British immigration. Australia, on the other hand, has more than it should, possibly the result of later waves of British immigrants in the 20th century bringing their cats with them. The proportion in Britain was over 80% in the 1970s and may have continued to rise since then. We can explain this trend by making 2 assumptions. The first is that the proportion of blotched tabbies in Britain has been rising steadily since about 1500, for some reason unique to that country. Otherwise, the same change should have taken place in, for example, New York, Nova Scotia, Brisbane, and Hong Kong, resulting in blotched tabbies reaching 80% of the population today in those places as well. The second is that once a population of cats becomes established in a particular place, the proportion of blotched to striped doesn't change. The latter assumption holds for other places and variations in coat color too, so it may be a universal. Listen to the section Reconstructing the Origins of the Cats of Humboldt County, California, at the end of this chapter. However, given that it seems not to have occurred anywhere else, the rise of the blotched tabby in Britain becomes even more curious. Relatively few of the domestic cats that colonized South America from Spain and Portugal were blotched tabbies, so scientists have had to turn to other variations in appearance to trace their history. Here also it seems that once a population of cats becomes established, its genetics doesn't change much, even over several centuries. It seems plausible that the cat population is set up when the initial human colonists bring their cats with them, and subsequent immigrants only adopt cats from the local population. For example, in the 19th century, Catalans from Barcelona established several towns along the River Amazon, and the cats of at least 2 of those towns, Leticia, Tabatinga, and Manaus, remain similar to the cats of Barcelona more than a century later. As in Hispanic-settled parts of the United States, and in Spain itself, orange and tortoiseshell cats are more common in South America than in most other places. The exceptions, where these colors are even more common, are Egypt, possibly one origin of this mutation, the islands off the north and west coasts of Scotland, and Iceland. Researchers have attributed these exceptions to a hypothetical preference for orange cats among the Vikings who colonized those places around the 9th century CE, but it is unclear whether the Vikings first obtained their orange cats from the eastern Mediterranean or whether orange appeared spontaneously and independently somewhere in Norway and was then transported around the Norwegian Sea in Viking ships. Today, cats come in many colors and coat types, and many of these variations are undoubtedly the result of human preferences, even leaving aside pedigree cats whose breeding is strictly under human control. The basic colors of cats, black, tabby, striped or blotched, ginger, are well established in populations all around the world, albeit in slightly different proportions. These colors persist in cats that have gone feral, so they do not seem to produce any major advantage or disadvantage to their wearers. However, many other variations in appearance seem to persist mainly because people like them. Cats with white feet and variable amounts of white on the body, the gene that controls this is rather imprecise in its effects, are less well camouflaged than their plainer counterparts, putting the cat at a disadvantage when hunting. However, many people prefer their cats to carry white patches, especially the black and white tuxedo cat. Some people also favor cats that carry a gene that dilutes their coat color, such that black cats become a fetching shade of gray, often referred to as blue, and other colors are a few shades lighter than usual. Some people like long-haired cats, although it seems self-evident that these cats, which cannot sweat through their coats, should be at a natural disadvantage in warm climates, a recent study of Latin American cats indicates that human preference is a much more potent factor than the weather, although a thick coat, such as that of the Maine Coon and the Norwegian forest cat, is undoubtedly beneficial for outdoor cats in cold climates. In temperate climates, the main disadvantage of long hair is not that the cat overheats, but that its coat easily becomes matted, which, if left unattended, leads to infection or infestation of the skin. Long-haired cats are rarely seen in feral colonies, testifying to their unsuitability for a life without attention from humans. The striped tabby pattern evidently suits wild cats the best, possibly because it provides the most effective camouflage for hunting. Presumably, mutations that affect appearance have occurred from time to time, but the wild cats that happened to carry them fared worse than their normal counterparts, so the mutation quickly died out. For a domestic cat, camouflage is probably less critical, allowing other coat colors to spread through the population. A similar variety of colors and coat types has, of course, also become a feature of many other types of domesticated animal, dogs, horses, and cattle, for example. In the case of the cat, external appearance reflects two distinct factors, both of which affect how many offspring a cat is likely to have, and therefore how common its coat color and type are likely to be in the next generation. The first is whether these factors impede the cat's hunting ability. This may not be so important today, but it certainly was in the past. The second is how appealing the cat is to its owner. Because human tastes vary from person to person and culture to culture, this second factor has produced many variations. What seems to be missing here is any trace of each cat's own preferences. Although never studied directly, we have no evidence for color prejudice among cats. Tabby females do not seem to spurn black toms in favor of other tabbies. A white bib and socks seems to be neither an advantage nor a disadvantage when it comes to finding a mate, except perhaps indirectly if the cat's conspicuousness has resulted in it catching less prey and thus looking less healthy than its better camouflaged rival. Whatever criteria cats use to choose a mate, coat color seems to be well down the list. Even today, most domestic cats exert a remarkable amount of control over their own lives, significantly more than other domestic animals, such as dogs. If we leave the pedigree breeds to one side for a moment, and these are still in a minority, most cats go where they please and choose their own mates, unless they are neutered, a relatively recent phenomenon. For this reason alone, cats cannot be considered completely domesticated. Footnote: Juliet Clutton Brock, formerly of the British Museum of Natural History in London, pointed this out in her 1987 book, A Natural History of Domesticated Mammals, New York, Cambridge University Press. Indian elephants, camels, and reindeer are among other domestic animals that exist, like the domestic cat, somewhere between wildness and full domestication. End of note. Full domestication means that humankind has complete control over what an animal eats, where it goes, and, most crucially, which individuals are allowed to breed and which are not. We certainly provide domestic cats with most or all of their food, but in this respect, too, cats are an anomaly. Science classifies them as obligate carnivores, animals that have to obtain a mostly meat-based diet if they are to thrive. Listen to the section, Cats Are the True Carnivores, at the end of this chapter. For a female cat to breed successfully, she must have a high proportion of flesh in her diet, especially in late winter, when she is preparing to come into season, and subsequently while she is pregnant. The domestication of such an animal takes some explaining. Until recently, meat and even fish formed only a minor part of most people's diets and were often only seasonally available. Most domesticated animals will thrive on foods that we ourselves cannot eat, unlocking sources of nourishment that would otherwise be unavailable to us. Cows turn grass, which we can't digest, into milk, and meat, which we can. Though classified as carnivores, even dogs are actually omnivores. They may prefer meat, but cereal-based foods can, if necessary, give them all the nutrition they need. For most of their coexistence with humankind, cats were valued primarily for their skill as hunters. Since mice contain all the nourishment a cat needs, a successful hunter automatically ate a balanced diet. Starvation was always possible for the less adept or the unlucky, but diseases due to specific nutritional deficiencies were unlikely. However, even historically, few domestic cats would have lived by hunting alone, most being provided with at least some food by their owners, supplementing their diet by scavenging. So long as some of their diet came from fresh meat, usually in the form of prey they had killed themselves, scavenging would not have tipped them into nutritional imbalance. Still, giving up hunting entirely would have been risky. Cats do not scavenge at random. They have some ability to make informed choices. They subsequently avoid foods that make them feel seriously and instantly ill. When eating food that they have not killed for themselves, they also deliberately seek out a varied diet, thereby avoiding a build-up of anything that might make them sick long-term, but might slip beneath the radar of immediate malaise. To demonstrate this behavior, I laid out individual pieces of dry cat food on a grid on the ground, some of one brand, some of another, and then allowed rescued strays to forage over them, one at a time. In this way, I could record in precisely what order each cat picked up and ate the pieces of the two foods. When there were equal numbers of each type of food, the cats roamed across the grid eating both foods, but more of whichever food they liked better. However, when one of the two foods made up 90% of the total, every cat, whatever its preference, stopped grazing indiscriminately within a couple of minutes and started actively seeking out the rarer food. Thus, these cats demonstrated a primitive nutritional wisdom, as if they assumed that eating a variety of food was more likely to produce a balanced diet than simply eating the food that was easiest to find, even though both the foods offered were nutritionally complete. Footnote: the idea of nutritional wisdom comes from Chicago-based pediatrician Clara Marie Davis's classic 1933 experiment, which showed that human infants, allowed to choose from 33 natural foodstuffs, would choose a balanced diet, even though each infant preferred a different combination of foods. End of note. When I gave similar choices to pet cats that had always had a balanced diet, few responded this way, most continuing to eat whichever of the two foods they liked better from the outset or were just easy to find. Thus, although all cats probably have the capacity to deliberately vary their diets, it seems that this ability must be awakened by some experience of having to scavenge for a living, as most of the stray cats in our original experiment must have done before they were rescued. Most other animals have more varied diets than cats. Rats, the best studied example, are omnivores with extremely wide tastes that suit them perfectly for a scavenging lifestyle. They employ several strategies that enable them to pick the right foods from the wide but unpredictable choices available to them. New foods are only nibbled at until the rat is sure that they're not poisonous. As soon as each food starts to be digested, the rat's gut sends information to its brain about its energy, protein, and fat content, enabling the rat to switch to another food with a different nutritional content if necessary. Cats are much less sophisticated in this regard, having traveled a different evolutionary path based on mainly eating fresh prey, which is by definition nutritionally balanced. Given their limited ability to subsist by scavenging alone, cats were locked into the hunting lifestyle until as recently as the 1980s. Until science revealed all of their nutritional peculiarities, it would have been a matter of luck whether a cat that wasn't able to hunt obtained a nutritionally balanced diet, unless its owner was both willing and able to give it fresh meat and fish every day. Although commercial cat foods have been available for over a century, there was initially little understanding that cats had very different requirements to dogs, and much of this food must have been nutritionally unbalanced. Commercial cat food that is guaranteed to be nutritionally complete has been widely available for only 35 years or so, only 1% of the total time since domestication began. In evolutionary terms, this is just a blink of an eye, and we have yet to see the full effects of this improvement in nutrition on cats' lifestyles. Just a few dozen generations ago, the cat that was a skillful and successful hunter was also the cat that stood the best chance of breeding successfully. Those cats that depended entirely on man for their food would usually obtain enough calories to keep them going day to day, but many would not have bred successfully because many of the cat's unusual nutrient requirements are essential for reproduction. Nowadays, any cat owner can go to the supermarket and buy food that keeps their cat in optimum condition for breeding. That is, of course, if the cat has not been neutered, another development that has yet to show its full effect on the cat's nature. Today's cat is thereby a product of historical turmoil and misconception. What would today's cats be like if they had not gone through centuries of persecution? It is possible that the effects may not have been particularly long-lasting. After all, since serious attempts were made to exterminate black cats in continental Europe because of their supposed association with witchcraft, they should still be uncommon there today, and they're not. Although undoubtedly many individual cats did suffer horribly, little lasting damage seems to have been done to the species as a whole. This is probably because, for most of the time, and in most places, particularly in the countryside, cat keeping was both enjoyable and practically beneficial, even if occasionally interrupted by an outburst of religious persecution. Changes have taken place. Cats today are significantly smaller and more varied in color than when they left Egypt, but they appear to have been mainly local rather than global. Thus, following the origin of their partnership in ancient Egypt, cats and humans continued to live alongside one another for a further 2,000 years without the cat ever becoming fully domesticated. Then, due to the nutritional discoveries of the 1970s, all cats, and not just the pets of the well-off, were relieved of the necessity to hunt for a living. However, their predatory past, so essential to their survival until recently, cannot be obliterated overnight. One of the most significant challenges facing today's cat enthusiasts is how to allow their cats to express their hunting instincts without causing wildlife the damage which evokes so much criticism from the anti-cat lobby. Reconstructing the Origins of the Cats of Humboldt County, California. Domestic cats arrived on the west coast of the USA by a variety of routes, by sea from the south and the north, and overland from the east. From the 16th to the 18th centuries, Humboldt County, on Northern California's Redwood Coast, received a succession of visitors and settlers, including Russians, British, and Spanish vessels exploring the Pacific coast, and farmers from both Missouri to the east and Oregon to the north. Feral cats, probably escapees from trading ships, were first recorded from Humboldt County in the 1820s, before the arrival of the first farmers, so today's cats could be the descendants of either or both. In the 1970s, biologist Bennett Blumenberg recorded the coat colors and patterns of 250 local cats, and from these determined the proportions of the different versions of each gene. For example, 56% of the cats were black or black and white, from which he was able to estimate that the black, non-agouti version of the gene was present in 75% of the population, the difference being made up of cats that were carrying one black version and one tabby, and were therefore outwardly tabby. He also recorded the numbers of orange and tortoiseshell cats, blotched versus striped tabbies, pale coats, long and short hair, all-white cats, and cats with white feet and bibs. Each one of these variations is controlled by a different and well-understood gene. He then compared these with cats from other parts of North America. The most similar were the cats of San Francisco, Calgary, and Boston, indicating that the ancestors of today's Humboldt County cats had mainly arrived overland with farmers and prospectors, or in the fur traders' vessels sailing out of Boston. However, he also found traces of cats of Spanish origin left behind after the demise of New Spain and its occupation of much of what is now California. Some otherwise unaccounted-for similarities were detectable with the cats of Vladivostok, home port of the Russian-American Trading Company. Their ships also sailed from ports that are now in China and could feasibly have carried cats of Chinese origin, but Blumenberg found no trace of Chinese cat genes in the Californian cats. Another rare mutation known as polydactyly gives cats an extra toe on each foot. Early in the establishment of Boston, one newly arrived cat must have produced a kitten with extra toes, and that kitten became the ancestor of many more, such that by 1848, extra-toed cats were common there. Today they form about 15% of the population. Cats with extra toes are also common in Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, a seaport founded by immigrants from Boston, whereas in nearby Digby, settled by New York loyalists at the end of the Civil War, polydactyly is as rare as it is everywhere else. Cats are the true carnivores. Cats are carnivores not by choice but by necessity. Many of their relatives in the animal kingdom, though referred to as carnivora, are actually omnivores, including domestic dogs, foxes, and bears, and some, like pandas, have reverted to being vegetarian. The whole cat family, from the lion down to the tiny black-footed cat from southern Africa, have the same nutritional needs. At some point, many millions of years ago, the ancestral cat became such a specialized meat-eater that it lost the ability to live on plants. It became a hyper-carnivore. Once lost, such capabilities rarely re-evolve. Domestic cats might have been more successful if they could have gotten by, as dogs can, living on scraps. But they are stuck firmly in the nutritional dead end their ancestors bequeathed to them. Cats require far more protein in their diet than dogs or humans do, because they get most of their energy not from carbohydrates, but from protein. Other animals, faced with a shortage of protein in the diet, can channel all the protein they do get into maintaining and repairing their bodies, but cats cannot. Cats also need particular types of protein, especially those that contain the amino acid taurine, a component that occurs naturally in humans but not in cats. Cats can digest and metabolize fats, some of which must come from animal sources, so that the cat can use them to make prostaglandins, a type of hormone essential for successful reproduction. Most other animals can make prostaglandins from plant oils, but cats cannot. Female cats must get enough animal fat during the winter to be ready for their normal reproductive cycle, mating in late winter and giving birth in the spring. Cats' vitamin requirements are also more stringent than ours. They need vitamin A in their diet. If needs be, we can make ours from plant sources. Sunshine doesn't stimulate their skin to make vitamin D as ours does, and they need lots of the B vitamins, niacin and thiamine. None of this is a problem if the cat can get plenty of meat, although raw fish, which contains an enzyme that destroys thiamine, can cause a deficiency if eaten in excess. It is slightly possible to construct a vegetarian diet for cats, but only if every single one of the cat's nutritional peculiarities are carefully compensated for. Their taste buds also differ substantially from our own, having evolved to focus better on an all-meat diet. They cannot taste sugars. Instead, they are much more sensitive than we are to how sweet some kinds of flesh are, compared to others which they find bitter. Cats do have two notable nutritional advantages over humans. First, their kidneys are very efficient, as expected for an animal whose ancestors lived on the edge of deserts, and many cats drink little water, getting all the moisture they need from the meat they eat. Second, cats do not require vitamin C. Taken together, these make cats well-suited to shipboard life. They don't compete with sailors for precious drinking water, getting all they need from the mice they catch, and they are not afflicted by scurvy, a common disease among mariners to the middle of the 18th century, when it was found it could be prevented by eating citrus fruits.